From the American College of Cardiology, this is Dr. Kim Eagle, ACC.org, Editor-in-Chief, with this week's Eagle's Eye View. This is your cardiovascular update, given every week from ACC.org. I chose three articles today that were published this week in JACC. The first one deals with trying to educate children about cardiovascular health, a wonderful study from the Bronx in New York. Another very interesting registry study looking at dietary patterns and incident heart failure. And then the last article is a 2019 consensus document about how we organize care for valvular heart disease. So let's get started. The first paper is a wonderful trial carried out by Dr. Fuster and colleagues in New York. It was a cluster randomized control study looking at 15 Head Start preschools in Harlem, New York. And the intervention was a educational session over 4 months, 50 hours of education, of which three quarters went to the child and about a quarter of it went to the parent. And this was randomized. And the educational program aimed to instill health behaviors in relation to diet, physical activity, body and heart awareness, and emotion management. And the primary outcome was measured looking at overall knowledge, attitudes, and habits using a score that has been validated previously. And it was assessed at 5 months. They also looked at the body mass index as well. So 562 children were enrolled. 400 of them had the intervention. About 150 had the standard curriculum. Mean age was 4 years. 51% were female, 5% were Hispanic, Latino, and 37% were African American. The outcome of interest, the children receiving the intervention had a significant improvement in their knowledge, 2.2-fold higher level of knowledge about their cardiovascular health and the things that were being measured. And there was a dose response. The children that had more than three quarters of the educational curriculum had the highest gain in knowledge. There was no difference in BMI. The study, I think, proves without doubt that a school-based educational intervention at the age of 4 years old can have an impact in helping students establish healthy behaviors and have knowledge of cardiovascular health that obviously may have a significant impact over their lifetime. Clearly, in our country, we see a very high rate of childhood obesity. It's much higher in lower socioeconomic areas. And so this wonderful study, Familia, gives us hope that if we can begin to implement legislation to introduce excellent educational programs, that we can begin to bend this curve in the direction of health. The second article is also about diet, and it's a study looking at dietary patterns and incident heart failure in U.S. adults who did not have known coronary disease. Obviously, we know that there's association between diet and heart disease, but a lot of it's been studied with coronary disease. This is a study looking more at heart failure. The study used the REGARDS cohort. REGARDS is a national prospective cohort of 30,000 participants over the age of 45 who were recruited between 2003 and 2007. And they were initially assessed for incident stroke and mortality, but this article looked at heart failure. The study design included a home visit for physical evaluation and then six-month follow-ups to evaluate things like food frequency and so on. The investigators divided diet into five patterns. One included, quote, convenience, which was loaded on fast food, meat, pasta. Plant-based, loaded more on fresh fruits, vegetables, and fish. Sweets and fats, which was loaded on desserts, bread, and sugar. Southern, more fried food, processed meats, added fats and sugar, sweetened beverages. And then lastly, alcohol slash salad, wine, liquor, beer, green salad dressing. And each of the participants had a score based on these five domains for kind of how their diet stacked up. And then they were followed and divided into quartiles based on the dietary pattern in each of the domains. And the primary outcome was incident heart failure, that is, incident hospitalization after they were enrolled up until 2014, or death. So this particular analysis included over 16,000 participants. They did not have heart failure or CAD at baseline. Their average age was 64 years, 58% were women, and about a third were black. Interestingly, participants in the highest quartile of plant-based diet were more likely to be women. They smoked less. They also had better outcomes. When we looked in the study at participants of the highest quartile of the southern pattern, that is, fried foods, processed meats, added fats, and so forth. Participants in the highest quartile of the southern pattern were more likely to be black, male, smokers, and have risk factors like hypertension and diabetes compared to the lowest quartile of that diet. So over nearly 9 years, there were 363 new heart failure hospitalizations. And after adjusting for known heart failure risk factors, having the higher plant-based diet, being in the highest quartile of that plant-based domain, was associated with 41% lowering of risk for incident heart failure. Contrarywise, if one was in the highest quartile of the high-fat group, the southern diet, their hazard ratio was 1.72. Interestingly, after multivariable adjustment, that hazard ratio dropped and was no longer significant. So probably what was happening there is that the southern diet was contributing to things like high cholesterol, hypertension, diabetes, and that once you adjusted for those, the diet itself was no longer felt to be significant, but it may have been fueling the risk factor itself. So this is a wonderful study looking at incident heart failure. It certainly suggests that a plant-based diet has benefit in lowering risk, and of course this would be a diet low in fat generally and lower in salt, which obviously is important in our patients who are at risk for heart failure. So excellent paper. And then the last article I want to talk about today was the 2019 consensus document on how we should organize care for valvular heart disease. This came from a number of societies, the AATS, ACC, ASC, SCAI, and STS. So just a couple of key points from this consensus document. All of us know that the therapy of valve disease has just completely gone off the Richter scale. So many new options, and accordingly, it's really important that we think about how we organize care. Clearly, the initial step in the management of valvular heart disease generally is recognition and subsequent diagnosis, usually by a primary care doctor or advanced practice provider or a general cardiologist. Then the second step in the management is often referral to a local general cardiologist for refinement of the diagnosis, how bad is the problem, initiation of medical therapy if indicated, and identification of patients who can be followed for the time being without more advanced therapy being considered. Centers designated as having valvular heart disease expertise have to be not only excellent at performing procedures, but they need to have a multidisciplinary team that's capable of assessing and managing patients according to evidence-based guidelines and emphasizing shared decision-making. The consensus document describes a primary level 2 valve center as the one that has at a minimum expertise and resources to perform surgical aortic valve replacement with or without CABG and transfemoral transcatheter AVR TAVR, the ability to perform durable mitral valve repair in patients with primary mitral regurgitation caused by, say, isolated posterior leaflet pathology is desirable but probably not mandatory. Level 1, or a comprehensive valve center, should have much more. They should have resources and capabilities to evaluate and perform all commercially available interventional and surgical procedures, including TAVR, and using non-transfemoral approaches, and also valve-in-valve TAVR, transcatheter mitral valve edge-to-edge repair, percutaneous closure of paravalvular leaks, complex surgical procedures, including complex aortic root procedures like valve-sparing root repair, and the ability, of course, to treat patients with very complicated infective endocarditis. Clearly, valve centers of excellence require access to high-quality echo and an echocardiographer who has expertise and interest in valvular heart disease. Level 1 centers also should have advanced imaging modalities, probably including 3D echo and cardiac MR, and interventional echocardiographers who work with the interventionalists and surgeons are really important in this enterprise. Valve centers should have a multidisciplinary team, which is formalized, composed of personnel with expertise in managing patients with these problems. It's generally recommended that valve centers participate in national registries. They should lead investigative efforts to evaluate new technology and improve clinical management of patients with valvular heart disease and provide ongoing educations to clinicians at local, national, and international conferences, and hopefully provide training to other valvular heart disease providers. I think it's a nice summary document. Clearly, as care areas change, like valvular heart disease, we need to change how we think about dealing with it and how we organize ourselves to put the right people in the room so that the patient can get individualized, excellent evidence-based therapy for their particular problem. So I want to thank you for listening to me today. This is Eagle's Eye View. I recorded this on April 22nd, 2019. This has been your weekly cardiovascular update from ACC.org. You can find this, of course, online at our website. Also, you'll find a new educational catalog feature on ACC.org. Find it under the Education and Meetings tab. Using that tool, you can sort our educational offerings by various formats, and many of these, of course, are free. Find us online or wherever you get your podcasts. And I look forward to talking to you again next week.